Yeah, eco-friendly living is definitely rat-free living.
A special 4th of July edition of Rosie on the House.
You know, July 4th is a pretty dangerous time for American presidents. Has anyone put a pulse on Carter? Make sure he's still breathing, or any of the either of the Bushes?
I haven't.
You haven't?
No.
Haven't? Yeah. Three presidents have died on July 4th. Two in the same year. The second and third presidents, Adams and Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
50 years after the signing, so 1826. And then 5 years later, James Monroe followed suit and passed away in 1831. Rough day to be a president.
I guess if you're one of those presidents, you're just living to see that day. You're living to see that next celebration. And once you've hit it and you're ill anyway, do you just give up the spirit at that point?
I made it. Well, what better day to go out on?
There was a president born on 4th of July. It was Calvin Coolidge?
It was. The 30th president. And the year of that would have been 1872. Just 3 years before Billy the Kid was shot in the back of the head on this day by Pat Garrett.
For heaven's sakes. My dad was born on 4th of July, and all his brothers and sisters hated him. He was the baby of the family, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. We're here visiting with the peculiar backstory to the Declaration of Independence with Dr. David Dean, Assistant Professor of History at Grand Canyon University. Again, Dr. Dean, thank you for joining us this Saturday morning at Rosie on the House.
Thank you for letting me be here.
Oh, man. So this day in history.
Yeah, a couple of other interesting points. In July 1863, July 4th, 1863.
Let's see. We're in the middle of the Civil War.
We're in the middle of the Civil War. Okay. Abraham Lincoln gets news of Union victories over the Confederates at Gettysburg that had been fighting for the previous 3 days, and the end of the siege at Vicksburg in Tennessee when Ulysses S. Grant accepts the surrender there. So two major victories over Confederate forces at the end of July of 1863. And then also, it's kind of a dark day for our centennial in 1876 when the newspapers carry the story about General Custer's downfall at Little Bighorn and the loss of 280 American soldiers there. And so kind of a dark way of celebrating the 4th on that day. Well, not a happy day for Americans on the centennial.
Well, I wasn't around for the centennial, but I remember where I was for the bicentennial. I was in Prescott, which, of course, is having their rodeo this weekend. If you,
128th annual.
Awesome.
World's oldest rodeo.
Awesome. And we were out at the airport, and they always did the firework displays out at the airport. And you drove out there, and there were literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cars. They would get together in a massive, huge picnic. And that was the bicentennial, 1976. I can remember it like it was yesterday. All right, we talked a little bit about the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and you can Google that, and you kind of read tear-jerking stories about the fate of the signers. 56 signers, they were lawyers, they were clergymen, they were physicians. I think there was one blue-collar worker in the deal, Sam Adams, a local brewer. but other than that, they were all fairly well-to-do, well-heeled patriots, as I read the list. Is that right?
Yeah. The interesting thing is they signed the Declaration of Independence at the bottom. They say, "We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." A way of kind of saying, you know, we're really in this. And it might hurt.
So you Google fate of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and you hear about losing sons in the war, losing wives to imprisonment to Britain. You read about being thrown in prison. You read about fortunes being lost, homes being bombed.
Yeah. The
what's the take on all that?
Well, the article that most people refer to is. It's a really good tradition. It's got a lot of interesting information that helps us give some insight into what the signers of our Declaration of Independence were going through. It's a revolutionary period, and so they're basically telling the king, we're committing treason, and we're willing to die for that. And some lost their fortunes, and some had to flee because they became fugitives of the king for treason. Many of them served either in the war or served in the Continental Congress, which was kind of chased around by the British a few times. And so,
do you feel, as a professor of history, did the Brits ever get a copy of the Declaration? Could they ever read through the names?
Yes, actually, in August 2nd of 1776 was when the signers actually came together and signed it. 50 of the members came together. Six others signed it later on. But basically, the draft, the copy that they signed, was August 2nd. And then that was sent off to the king as a letter. There was also a copy made. And then they actually commissioned the Dunbar broadside, which was the printed copy, 200 copies that were distributed around the colonies to be read in the public squares and whatnot, of which there's only about 26 of those left.
Oh, there are still some left. Wow.
26 left. The last one was found in like 2002, kind of like a find on the back of a painting, in a frame. It sold for $8 million at auction.
Well, didn't y'all at Grand Canyon University just discover some hidden document in the bottom of a box somewheres? One of your interns?
Yes, John Adams. We had one of our students is doing an internship over in San Diego and found
his name is John Adams?
No, that my student's name is Francisco Lira, but he found a letter signed by John Adams in a box over in San Diego. So, yes, the documents come up, can be discovered kind of anywhere, attic or somewhere.
So when the university's intern discovers that, now do you have a fight with California who owns that document and who has the right to put it to auction?
Well, the museum there owns that document. It was given to them in a set of stuff that they really didn't know what to do with. And so they're going to display it because it is it's a maritime museum, and it's a letter referring to maritime trade and commerce. And so it's appropriate to be there if they want it there.
Yeah. Being a great fan of history, we were digging through some family documents not too long ago back home in South Louisiana, and my father was a physician, and we have a long line of physicians in the family. And it's interesting to pull out the 19th century documents of how much each person in the community owed this particular doctor and how the tabulations would just get tabulated up. And then when the rice harvested, how much, it was just so interesting to read the birth dates of all the cousins and, $3.75 for my cousin Paul to be born, which was too much. I know him. That it should have never paid that much to have him born, that's for sure. But those kind of history documents, you're peeling through them, and they've got the aroma of age on them. They've got the mystique of history on them. And when he saw that at the bottom of the box, it must have just been absolutely incredible.
He was pretty thrilled about it. And he got his supervisor, came over, and they talked about it. They had to find out some more information about it, the context of it and whatnot, which actually turns out that it was the context of the quasi-war with France that we were fighting in 1789. Right after we became a new country, our friend France now thought that we were competition on the high seas. And so they didn't like us trading with their colonies down in Caribbean area. And so, can't always be friends all the time,
Well, boy, without France, we would have never had Cornwallis trapped at Yorktown to finish the war.
Right. It was a great relationship between Washington and Lafayette, but also the work of Ben Franklin over in France to negotiate that treaty, not only a treaty of alliance, but later the Treaty of Paris that ended the war.
Do I have my history right? I mean, Washington has the Marquis de Lafayette on the ground holding Cornwallis from escaping by ground. And then he has this French fleet arrive in the Chesapeake Bay and basically prevents Cornwallis from leaving by sea. Without the French, we're dead.
Right.
We're done. We're
right.
Cooked.
De Grasse was actually stationed down in the Caribbean, the French admiral, and was told to bring his fleets up. And he just kind of timed it to go right into the Chesapeake right about the time that Cornwallis couldn't get anywhere. And his friend DeWitt DeWitt Clinton up in New York couldn't come down by sea to rescue him because the French Navy's in the way. And so that kind of trapped Cornwallis there, and he's like surrendered.
As they're surrounded, then Washington just unlevies like 3 weeks of a constant barrage. I'm surprised how few casualties there were at the Battle of Yorktown. I'm just glad it ended the way it did.
Right. A bombardment of the fort there would have basically been a morale defeater. Cornwallis was so demoralized that he refused to actually surrender to George Washington himself. He sent an aide with his sword out.
With the sword, that's right. Out
because he was too embarrassed, and too defeated, or however you say, to...
So Cornwallis, the prime of Great Britain's massive global artillery strength, is sitting in this little community of Yorktown, Virginia, being bombarded constantly, waiting for his other adjutant, General Clinton, to show up from New York. Clinton never even leaves New York, right?
Never really leaves. He gets word that the French Navy's out there, and he's like, I think I'll stay right here in New York.
Now, I'm really, really counting on the fact that when I breathe my last breath here on Earth, that where I go, there's going to be an accurate History Channel that I can watch for like 5 or 10,000 years. Because there's just certain episodes of history I want to see. And I want to see Clinton and Cornwallis talking to King George about the loss of the colonies.
Blaming each other. Well, you should have done this. Well, you shouldn't have done that. Well, I was here and you did. Well, you could imagine they were trying to point the finger at somebody else.
Cornwallis must have just been absolutely infuriated.
He really thought pretty low of the colonists, and to have lost to George Washington, this upstart farmer from Virginia, really was a blow to his ego.
All right. We're going to come back and talk one more tradition. Did you know we had a tradition here in Arizona that dates back 135 years? It's blowing an anvil up into the sky to celebrate the 4th of July. It happens 5:30 in the morning every 4th of July. In the community of Taylor, Arizona. We're going to bring in a family member from Taylor, Arizona, whose family's been doing this every single year since 1880. Anvil blasting. What could be better than that?